Chapter 3. History of UFOs. Part 2. Then in 1957 we had the Antonio Villas Boas incident in Brazil. A man named Antonio Villas Boas claimed to have been abducted and examined by aliens. He also claimed to have had intercourse with an alien woman while he was on board the UFO ship.
The case of a young Brazilian farmer Antonio Villas Boas took place in 1957, 4 years before Betty and Barney Hill had their encounter. Antonio Hunnies, journalist.
Antonio Villas Boas was a farmer and basically, chronologically speaking, would be the first abduction case.
John Schuessler, former international director, MUFON.
He claimed he saw an object come down out of the sky and land nearby.
He reported that he was taken, captured by these two aliens that landed near his tractor.
Villas Boas was taken inside the craft and his clothes were taken from him. He was put in a chamber that filled up with a gas that made him sick. Most believe the gas was some sort of disinfectant. A naked female alien entered the chamber and she and Villas Boas had sexual relations. He even reported that he was bit on the chin. He was then dropped off back in the field with his tractor and the UFO took off. Villas Boas soon began to notice strange marks and burns on his body. He was examined by Alago de Font, a professor at the National School of Medicine. Font was a pioneer in Brazilian ufology and a well-connected man, with ties to the Brazilian government and military. Font diagnosed Villas Boas with radiation poisoning and declared that he was a good case, a case with merit. Antonio Villas Boas' claims of abduction are further supported that he never sought fame or tried to capitalize on his experience.
In fact, the case wasn't even written or published until several years after. And he later became a lawyer and went to Brasilia, and never profited from his UFO experience.
And he eventually died of a very strange disease, and we never did know exactly what, but we did know that he came to the United States and was tested at one of the medical universities in California, and after that it wasn't too long until he passed away.
Then in 1957 we had the Leveland UFO case in Leveland, Texas, and this is the account where numerous motorists reported seeing a glowing, egg-shaped object which caused their vehicle's engines to shut down. When the object flew away, their vehicles restarted without a problem. In 1959 we have Dyatlov Pass incident in Russia. There were several mysterious deaths of experienced skiers in the Ural Mountains that were reported to have been caused by unidentified orange spheres and an unknown compelling force.
February 1959, a group of nine mountaineers embark on a winter trek into Russia's Ural Mountains. Their destination, a mountain named Mount Ototan, which in the local Mansi language means "do not go there." Paul Stonehill, author, UFO Case of Russia.
Among them were three experienced engineers, the rest were students. They were all young. I think the oldest was 37 years old. They had conducted other hard treks through the area. They were all experienced, strong-willed, determined people.
On their fourth night out, bad weather forced the hikers to camp atop an area called Kolat Sayakal, which in Mansi translates to Mountain of the Dead. Paul Stonehill.
It was a very inhospitable, very strange, a very hard place to be. Snow, cold, freezing winds, and very few living things around. They decided that they would spend the night of February 1st in an open area not too far away from the top of the mountain. They didn't want to go back to the forest, 1.5 kilometers, because it would take them too much time and they would lose the day.
10 days later, when the nine adventurers fail to show up at their destination, military rescue teams search the area. They find the hikers' camp abandoned and a tent that is badly damaged. Investigators determine that the tent has been cut and ripped open from the inside and the hikers appeared to have fled the area in only socks or bare feet. Mikhail Gerstein, Russian researcher/journalist.
This tent had been cut with knives from the interior. It was absolutely obvious that neither animals nor people had approached the tent to break in, meaning that nothing from this earth had approached them.
Paul Stonehill.
Something was pushing them to run away without taking any clothing with them, without taking any supplies. They were behaving like they were in a daze, confused.
The investigators followed the trail to the edge of the forest, but what they eventually find is beyond belief. Bill Burns, J.D., Ph.D.
All nine hikers died. they were discovered by Soviet troops in various stages of what can only be described as being mutilated. Their bodies were burned, some suffered radiation poisoning, and in one case a hiker's tongue was missing. They had prematurely aged, their skin was orange, their hair had turned gray. What could have explained this?
Paul Stonehill.
Three of them had injuries that could be sustained when somebody is hit by a speeding car. Except the injuries were inside. Their ribs were crushed like eggshells and some of them entered their hearts, but there was no effect on their skin. It was like a force was directed at all of them.
Mikhail Gerstein.
An unknown force had hit the hikers and it was very selective in hitting only the hikers, leaving untouched the snow, the trees, and everything else around.
The official explanation was that the nine died from hypothermia, but the chief investigator refused to sign off on the report and instead resigned from the inquiry. Paul Stonehill.
When the investigation was taking place by the local officials, one of the people in charge was removed quite quickly from the investigation because he was very thorough and local officials did not want this to come out.
Mikhail Gerstein.
The authorities did their best to cover the whole thing up. It was practically forbidden to mention it.
Paul Stonehill.
At the end, the bodies were buried in zinc coffins, I believe, so nobody could see. But it was enough of the investigation, enough people had seen what had been going on and were amazed at what they found, including the coloration of the corpses when they were found and other things that news broke out, and this is one of the most mysterious murder cases in the former Soviet Union. I am convinced it was a murder. But they were not killed by anything we know. They were killed by an unknown force.
Years later, members of the search party spoke out. According to their testimony, at the time of the incident, strange orange spheres or orbs were seen floating in the sky. Mikhail Gerstein.
These observations were from local people who saw some unidentified flying objects during the night of the hikers' deaths. I think there is a clear connection.
Paul Stonehill.
Locals know they exist, it's like a part of life. They don't put too much attention to them and they hope and pray that the fire spheres don't bother them. It's not a coincidence that UFOs were reported by these hikers in the Ural Mountains in the place of the dead, they do not go there because I believe that many UFO sightings come here from a parallel reality and they come through portals. In 1961 we have the Betty and Barney Hill abduction in New Hampshire. This is probably one of the most widely publicized alien abduction experiences around. Betty and Barney Hill reported that they had been kidnapped for a short time by a UFO while driving back from vacation.
Betty and Barney Hill might seem like unlikely candidates to rewrite UFO history. Betty was a department supervisor in the state government and Barney worked for the U.S. Postal Service. They were driving home to New Hampshire from a vacation in Canada when their encounter began. As they motored down Route 3 in the isolated White Mountains, Betty noticed a curious star in the sky that seemed to be following their car.
The Hills stopped the car as the light got closer to them.
Peering through binoculars, Barney reported seeing red, amber, and green flashing lights. Panicked, Barney jumped back in the car and started speeding down the road.
When the Hills arrived home to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, they realized that the trip had taken 2 hours longer than expected.
Within days of their sighting, Betty Hill began having nightmares in which she and Barney were taken aboard a flying saucer and then medically examined. The Hills filed a sighting report with NICAP, a newly formed UFO research group. Then the emotional trauma from their experience prompted Barney and Betty Hill to seek the help of Dr. Benjamin Simon, a prominent Boston psychiatrist. Dr. Simon used hypnosis to treat the Hills over the course of several months.
Betty and Barney Hill said the therapy helped them recover some memories of their missing 2 hours.
Listening to recordings of these sessions brought back even more recollections.
I tried to maintain control, so Betty cannot tell I am scared, God I'm scared.
Go right on, you experienced it. It will not hurt you now.
I got to get my gun. Oh, they got my gun. Ah.
All right, that's all. Alright, just keep breathing and be calm.
I put it in my coat and then I get out with the binoculars and then it's there and I look. I look and see something, and I think I am not afraid, I'll shoot it down, so I'm not afraid and I walk out, and I walk across the road. There it is up there. No. No.
Calm down, calm down. It's there, you can see it, but it's not gonna hurt you. Go on.
Why doesn't it go away?
Barney Hill would later make sketches to illustrate his story.
It's very big and it's not that far, and I can see it that it's tilted toward me.
What does it look like now, when you say tilted? Did you see wings?
It looks like a big, big pancake with windows, and rows of windows, and rows of windows.
Rows of windows, like a commercial plane?
Rows of windows, they're not like a commercial plane because they curve around to the sides of this pancake and I look up and down the road. Can't somebody come tell me this is not there?
During her hypnotic regression, Betty Hill described the deeply disturbing events that she said took place inside the landed spacecraft. Betty Hill.
And then they rolled me over on my back and they take out a long needle. I see the long needle in his hand and it's bigger than any needle I've ever seen. I asked him what he's going to do with it and he said he's going to use it to hurt me and I ask him, why? And he said he just wants to put it in my nail. I tell him no, it will hurt, don't do it. And he puts it in my nail and I am crying and it's hurting, and I tell him it's hurting, get it out. Then the leader, he comes over and he puts his hand in front of my eyes and he said I'll be alright, I won't feel it and all the pain goes away.
5 years later, the bizarre experience of Betty and Barney Hill became legendary as a cover story in Look magazine and a book entitled The Interrupted Journey. It was the first reported alien abduction in the United States.
Their claim of alien abduction was also adapted into the 1975 television movie The UFO Incident, and its importance is such that many of Betty Hill's notes, tapes and other items have been placed in a permanent collection at the University of New Hampshire, and as of July 2011, the site of the alleged abduction is marked by a state historical marker. And speaking of abductions by alleged UFOs, before we proceed, let's go ahead and categorize the seven various kinds of encounters with UFOs. A close encounter of the first kind refers to a person seeing a UFO. A close encounter of the second kind refers to a person seeing a UFO with physical effects. Heat, radiation, animal reactions, etc. A close encounter of the third kind refers to a person seeing an actual alien creature. A close encounter of the fourth kind refers to a person being abducted by a UFO. A close encounter of the fifth kind refers to a person having communication with a UFO, alien. A close encounter of the sixth kind refers to a person being injured or dying from a UFO. A close encounter of the seventh kind refers to a person mating with a UFO occupant, alien. But in 1964 we have Lonnie Zamora incident in Socorro, New Mexico. Lonnie Zamora was a New Mexico police officer who reported a UFO sighting while on duty on Friday, April 24, 1964 near Socorro, New Mexico. His account received considerable coverage in the mass media and is sometimes regarded as one of the best documented, yet most perplexing UFO reports.
It happened in Socorro, New Mexico, here just outside of this quiet desert town. A State Highway Patrol officer, Lonnie Zamora, was on duty, as he had been for the past several years. A black Chevrolet was observed speeding by the courthouse. Zamora put his highway patrol car into pursuit. Lonnie chased the car north on US 85. As he passed this hilly area, Zamora heard a roar and something caught his attention. 10 or 15 seconds passed. Lonnie then calls into the sheriff's office. Sheriff.
The time was about 5:45, I recall, and he said, Zamora to 10 to 44, an accident. And then he said, I'll be it sticks out of the car, which means he was going to be investigating the possible accident.
And I went up this road about a half mile and then I stopped my car and got out. I thought it was an overturned car at first, but I get into the patrol car and went up closer to it. When I started to get out of the car, I heard a big roar. As I got to it, I could see what looked like a couple of coveralls hanging from a clothesline. I couldn't see what it was, but it looked like a couple of coveralls.
Zamora called in. He sounded very excited. He said he watched an object lift up slowly and disappeared into the sky very fast.
I went down to where the object had been, and I noticed the brush was burning in several places. The object had left four perpendicular impressions in the ground. I noticed that several bushes were smoldering, but they felt cold to the touch. I noticed what appeared to be a couple of footprints on the ground.
I knew Lonnie had seen something, The proof was right there.
The incident was very interesting, to say the least. It seems to differ from practically all the earlier cases we investigated from one standpoint. The vehicle had left pod marks. There was an insignia observed by Lonnie Zamora on the side of the craft. The insignia was unidentifiable, not American nor Russian. And last of all, the observation of these two people in some sort of suit.
In fact, it was Zamora's account that helped persuade astronomer J. Allen Hynek, who was one of the primary investigators for the Air Force, that some UFO reports were an intriguing mystery. Also, several other independent witnesses reported either an egg-shaped craft or a bluish flame, at roughly the same time Zamora has his encounter in the same area, some of them just within minutes. And several other stories appeared in local newspapers in the succeeding days of other sightings of oval-shaped objects, including another landing with burned soil in northern New Mexico. In 1965, we have the Exeter incident in Exeter, New Hampshire. Here a UFO was observed by a teenager and two police officers. This sighting remains among the best documented and best publicized in UFO history and is even celebrated by an annual event. In 1965, we also have the Kecksburg UFO incident in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania. There was a mass sighting of a falling UFO followed by a cordoning off of the crash site. It was reported to be an acorn-shaped UFO that had crashed into the woods and was purportedly taken away by military personnel. In 1966, we also have the Mothman sightings in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. A wave of sightings of a strange winged humanoid creature that began to be reported throughout the area and was reported to be connected to other mysterious events that included the sightings of UFOs. In 1966, there was the Waunakee Reservoir UFO sighting in Waunakee, New Jersey. A UFO was seen in the vicinity of the Waunakee Reservoir in New Jersey that led to traffic jams and overloaded police communications. It shifted colors on a continual basis and reportedly shot down a beam of light towards the ice near the dam and maintained its position for another half hour, then flew off to the southeast. Then another UFO was sighted the next night flying in a zigzag pattern. The mayor, Warren Hogstrom, as well as Chief of Police Floyd Elston and Captain Joe Sisko watched the craft for some time. Then two reserve officers, Sergeant Ben Thompson and Patrolman Edward Wester, also witnessed the craft along with a number of other observers. In 1966, we had the Westall UFO encounter in Australia. This is the account where more than 200 students and teachers at two Victorian state schools witnessed a UFO that descended into a nearby open grass field. They described it as being a gray saucer with a slight purple hue about twice the size of a family car. After about 20 minutes, the object climbed at high speed and departed towards the northwest.
Back nearly 40 years, witnessed by 200 people, who say it was kept secret by the military. As Brian Seymour reports, more light is being shone on Australia's Westall incident. This boy came running in saying, "Mr. Greywood, there's these things in the sky, there's these things in the sky." We looked up and we just saw this saucer-type thing taking off. It wasn't a plane, it wasn't a balloon, it was nothing like that. A lot of the kids took off towards where it seemed to go. All of the students were just running all over the place, hysterical. Went to the high school as the tension, the situation ceased. My girlfriend and I sat on the fence, climbed the fence, the school boundary, and we were crying thinking it was the end of the world. For 44 years, the story about what happened at Westall has been largely untold, all covered up. Joy Clark, that afternoon our principal called a special assembly and told us all not to talk about it. Principal, I was prepped to tell the students that what they'd seen didn't exist. We were told that we weren't allowed to speak to the media. You've most likely heard about the best-known UFO encounter that happened in Roswell, New Mexico, in 1947, but the fifth greatest UFO encounter happened a world away, just southeast of Melbourne in the suburb of Clayton South. It happened at Westall High School Wednesday, April 6, 1966. At recess time about 11 o'clock in the morning. Scientists and UFO experts have long known about the Aussie sighting, but until now the details have been locked in our past. Joy Clark, all I knew was what I saw, and it was definitely not any aircraft of the day, by any stretch of the imagination, and it was certainly not a weather balloon. Victor Zakruzny, it was amazing and something that I've never forgotten. Victor Zakruzny was in second form when he says he had a very close encounter. After watching with over 150 other children, a mysterious saucer-shaped craft landed, and he decided to approach it. Victor Zakruzny, you could feel heat coming off of it. It was pretty warm or hot, and then it just gradually lifted up, and went off towards the pines. We are talking about 200 people, and a lot of them were kids too, they're at school, so I mean, I think adults have got preconceptions about what a UFO might or may not be, but kids are a different matter. When you got 200 witnesses, either there was something strange in the lunch shop that day, or there was something else going on. A news crew interviewed several students at the school right after the event, so filmmaker Chain Ryan tracked down the tape. But oddly, there was nothing there. Chain Ryan, I was absolutely devastated, and nobody had any idea where it had gone. A teacher saw one of his colleagues, who had taken pictures, confronted by a man in a dark blue suit. It was demanded that she hand over not only the film, but the entire camera. However, one written account survives in the Dandenong Journal newspaper, which reported the occurrence, questioned the involvement of the military, and the cover-up by school officials. The one thing we would really like is that someone, either from the police or the military, would come forward and say, yes, they were there. Some of the surviving witnesses are appealing to those with official information to come forward. Incredibly, and despite the involvement of the Army, Air Force, and police, there is not one single mention of the Westall incident in any government files. You'd ask me if an RAND establishment would destroy evidence. Yes, of course they would. This is happening in the 60s, right? And in a lot of countries in the world, a lot of governments were concerned about UFO sightings, not from the perspective of invasion, but mass hysteria. Documentary maker Chain Ryan has an obsession with what occurred at Westall. His pieced together and recorded scores of interviews with the school children, who are all now in their 50s and 60s. Paul Smith, I looked up and I was facing the object in the sky, and I just thought, somebody's just got a way of projecting a film of something into the sky. I didn't believe that it was really happening, but my boss turned around and he saw it, and we stood there looking at it for several minutes. We crossed and walked down here to this corner. After a while, trucks turned up with what looked like army trucks. Jacqueline Argent, I was called down to the headmaster's office, and there were two men in the headmaster's office, very well-dressed gentlemen, in suits. They were introduced to me in person, and I don't know where they came from. But my references now, as an adult, I would say they were from Asia. Then we went into, well, I suppose you think you saw a flying saucer. And I was like, no, I didn't say that. I said, I think I saw an object. And they said, and we suppose you saw little grey men. When I came out, I think I burst into tears. They were sent by the Australian government, and I think it was part of their job to keep everything quiet. The authorities had found a way to silence the children, but they still had unfinished business with a teacher, Andrew Greenwood. He told me that two officers came to his home and threatened him under the Official Secrets Act. They said that he couldn't have seen a flying saucer at Westall because there were no such things as flying saucers. They threatened to tell people he was an alcoholic even though he wasn't. Jacqueline Argent, it was their job to squash what was being seen. It was a bunch of kids who saw this, so we'll be able to squash this down.
In 1966, we also had the Portage County UFO chase in Ohio. In this report, several police officers were said to have pursued a UFO for about 30 minutes. In 1967, we also have Falcon Lake incident in Canada. This is the account where a UFO's exhaust allegedly burned a man. 11. In 1967 was the close encounter of Cusac in France. This is a story of a young brother and sister who claimed to have witnessed a UFO and its occupants. In 1967 was the Shag Harbor incident in Nova Scotia. A UFO was seen crashing into Shag Harbor in Nova Scotia, whereupon a Canadian naval search followed. The incident was not only officially referred to as a UFO crash, but the crash left behind a strange yellow foam that, of all things, smelled like burning sulfur.
The officers wasted no time getting to the scene of the crash, near an Irish moss plant overlooking the harbor. When officers first drove into the parking lot of the plant, there was already a crowd of locals gathering that were trying to figure out what was happening in the waters of the Sound. What they saw when they got there was a pale yellow light that appeared to be as much as 8 feet above the surface of the water, and it was moving under its own power. It was moving in the direction of the ebbing tide, but it seemed to be moving at a greater rate than that, and it was trailing a wide path of yellow foam. It just looked like a yellow glow, that's all we could see. While we were watching it, there was 3 RCMP officers and myself, and I don't know who else was there just watching it disappear. It disappeared different than anything I had ever seen. It didn't look like it sank, it didn't look like it went out, I don't know, it just disappeared. Whenever there was trouble on the water, the RCMP relied on local fishermen for help. Lawrence Smith was on his way to bed when he received an urgent phone call. Lawrence Smith, we navigated the RCMP boys up through the rocks up to the Prospect Point Wharf and then we opened her up, full speed. Smith and his crew were the first to get underway. Soon other fishermen raced to the scene joining Smith in the search. Lawrence Smith, when we got there, there was no light, no people in the water where we thought there would be for a plane crash and all we found was foam. Instead of wreckage, rescuers encountered a peculiar patch of foam. Lawrence Smith, there was a little smell, like sulfur, burnt sulfur. Several local fishermen who had witnessed the foam felt strongly that this was not normal tidal foam. Besides the fact that they are acquainted with the local conditions, there were several key features that made it stand apart. The sparkle, the way it dissipated, the sheer amount of it, the density of it implied something quite unusual. Lawrence Smith, I have been fishing that area for 45 years. I have never seen any foam like that ever on the water, and if you were motoring out going fishing, and you went through something like that, you would stop and say, what's been going on here?
In 1967 was the Shermer abduction in Nebraska. Sergeant Herbert Shermer claimed he was abducted by aliens after seeing a blurred white object that came out of what he had at first mistaken for a truck because of its blinking red lights. The white object not only communicated mentally with him, but Shermer even said it prevented him from drawing his gun. Oddly enough, he also reported that the UFO occupants wore badges that depicted a winged serpent. In 1968, we have the Minot Air Force Base incidents in North Dakota. This account involves Air Force claims that an unidentifiable craft buzzed the airbase, specifically the missile silos. The airmen who witnessed this encounter still have not received an adequate explanation.
Across remote stretches of the northern United States, the Air Force kept ballistic missiles and B-52 bombers on constant alert. On the night of October 24, 1968, in Minot Air Force Base in Minot, North Dakota, Airman First Class Mike O'Connor was dispatched to make a routine repair at one of the missile sites. Airman First Class Mike O'Connor, we made our turn to come down the road to the missile site and out of the corner of my eye I observed what I thought was a farmer's yard light, but it looked awful bright. As we proceeded down the road, the object appeared to lift off the ground and parallel us down the road until we came to the missile site, at which point we got out of the truck and it just kind of hovered there. Staff Sergeant Bill Smith oversaw security for 10 nuclear missiles. That night he reported seeing strange objects. Sergeant Bill Smith, these objects would rise, they would speed up, they would slow down, they would hover. They would dart very quickly one way or the other. We were just not really sure that these were things that we could explain. The Minot control tower diverted a B-52 to investigate. Captain Brad Runyon was the B-52's co-pilot. Captain Brad Runyon, the air traffic controller, asked us if we would mind going out to this one area and looking for something. I was curious, and I said, well, what are we looking for? And they said, well, you'll know it if you find it. The navigator on the B-52, Captain Patrick McCaslin, suddenly identified an object on his radar screen. Captain Patrick McCaslin, I saw a return, faint one sweep, bright the next, large the next, off our right wing 3 o'clock at about 3 miles. At that point I asked the radar navigator to turn on the camera, which would then take pictures of whatever is on the radar screen. This picture of the radar screen shows the object flying in formation with the B-52. Captain Patrick McCaslin, this thing was climbing out with us and maintaining the same heading we were. That was unusual, but what really watered my eyes was when this thing backed away and allowed us to turn inside of it. When the object suddenly disappeared from the radar, the bomber turned back to find it. Co-pilot Runyon was the first to spot what appeared to be a glowing craft hovering near the ground. "Captain Brad Runyon, when things like that are happening, it seems like time just stands still. My estimate for the overall object was a minimum of 200 feet in diameter and was hundreds of feet long. It had a metallic cylinder attached to another section that was shaped like a crescent moon. I felt as though this crescent moon part was probably the command center. I tried to look inside the thing, but all I could see was a yellow glow. At that point, I was fairly sure that I was looking at an alien spaceship, that this was something that had come here from some other planet other than the Earth." Co-pilot and the other crew members of the B-52 crew reported their sightings when they returned to the base. According to Blue Book's investigation, the crew of the B-52 and 16 witnesses on the ground said they saw a UFO that night. In its final report, Blue Book concluded that they were all seeing stars. "None of those pilots saw a star. I know those pilots. I know what their training was. I know how many stars they had seen in the course of their careers. They were not looking at a star. It bothers me that Blue Book blew it off. I don't think that this incident has ever been adequately explained."
In 1969, there was the famous Jimmy Carter UFO incident outside of Leary, Georgia. One evening in 1969, 2 years before he became governor of Georgia, Jimmy Carter was preparing to give a speech. When he spotted a strange object that was visible about 30 degrees above the horizon to the west of where he was standing. Carter described the object as being bright white and about as bright as the moon. It was said to have appeared to close in on where he was standing but stopped beyond a stand of pine trees some distance from him. It then changed color, first to blue, then to red, then back to white, before appearing to recede into the distance. He filed a report of the sighting, and since its writing, the report has been discussed several times by both ufologists and by members of the mainstream media.
One fall evening in 1969, Georgia Governor Jimmy Carter was preparing for a speech in the little town of Leary, when he spotted a bright object in the western sky. Carter describes his experience. "Governor Jimmy Carter, there were about 20 of us standing outside of a little restaurant, I believe, a lunchroom, and kind of a green object appeared in the western sky right after sundown, and it got brighter and brighter, and then just disappeared. It didn't have any solid substance to it, it was just a very peculiar looking light. None of us could understand what it was."
In the 1970s, we had the Barry DeLong UFO incident in Maine, and this is the account where Sheriff Barry A. DeLong witnessed a UFO and said, "They were hovering about 15 feet from my cruiser, late at night. It had fixed, spinning lights. The craft was a huge oval shape. I knew it wasn't a jet fighter. It slowly started backing off toward Sugarloaf, and then accelerated at a terrific speed." In 1973 was the Pascagoula abduction in Mississippi. An alien abduction is alleged to have occurred while the victims were fishing on the Pascagoula River, as this interview shows.
Charles Hickman, in the fall of last year on October the 16th, Calvin Parker and myself were employed at that time by F.P. Walker and Son Shipyard in Pascagoula. Sometime during the day on October 11th, we decided to go fishing after work. Something that I do quite often when I'm not working is fishing. So, after we got off work probably about 4:30, I think, we were working 9 hours. I came home, and I went to get my fishing gear. So, we got our bait and went to the river. We tried several spots, but the fish didn't seem to be biting. So, there was one more spot that we were going to try. In the past I had caught fish there a lot of times, the old abandoned Shell Peters shipyard. So, we went back up the river to the old shipyard, and it had become dark at that time. We did do quite a bit of fishing after dark that time of year. So, I don't know what had attracted my attention, as I reached around to get more bait, which was sitting behind us. I heard some sort of zipping-like sound, like the sound of steam escaping from a pipe, and as I turned around I saw two blue flashing lights, or pulsating lights, I'm not sure, and it seemed like there was some type of craft. It seemed like it was almost down on the ground. In fact, it seemed to be a couple of feet above the ground, and it just hovered there. Calvin had also turned by this time. He was looking at it too, and really, I didn't know what to do. I was just spellbound there for a few minutes, and then almost immediately some type of opening appeared on the end. It was towards us, which is what I assumed would be the front end. The light had come outside, but it was a real, real bright light, and three things appeared in the doorway of the craft. They seemed to just glide out of the craft. They never seemed to touch the ground, they just seemed to glide across. It must have been 25 to 30 feet from us. Then they just glided over to us. Two of them took me by the arms on either side, and one took hold of Calvin. I saw Calvin go limp and I didn't know it then, but he had fainted. So they carried me inside the craft. The light was almost blinding inside. In fact, for 3 or 4 days after that I had something like a bad welding flash in my eyes. I can't recall, or I can't remember, just what was on the inside simply because the light was so bright that I just couldn't make out what it was, but I didn't see any tables or chairs and the room seemed to be round, but of course that could have been because the light was glowing from the walls, the floor, and the ceiling. They carried me to what I guess was the middle of the room, and we just seemed to be suspended there. I couldn't move, I didn't have any feelings, no sensation of any feelings. It seemed something like a big eye, I keep referring to it as an eye because it was about the size of a small baseball, and in the end, it was focused towards me. It was a different color, a different light, and it seemed to come directly out from the wall. It came within 6 or 8 inches of my face, and it remained there for a few minutes, a very few minutes. Then it went over my entire body. I'm assuming it did because when it went down, like this, I was suspended, then the next time I see it, it was coming back up over this way, so I assume it went over my entire body. But it came back in front of my face, and it stayed there for a few more minutes, and it seemed to just go right back into the wall. These things, the way they were holding me, weren't as tall as me and they were upright, and I was elevated. I could see, I could move my eyes, the only thing I could move, and I could see that they had released me. I don't know where they went, whether they went outside the craft or another room or compartment, but they didn't come back in front of me. They left me that way for a few minutes, I don't know how long, and then after a while they came up to the side of me and took hold of me again and carried me back outside of the craft. We were still just gliding. I wasn't touching anything that I know of, and they seemed to just glide out to where they had taken me and put me back down on the ground. Well, when they did, I fell because my legs were weak, and they just gave way on me, and it was at this time that I saw Calvin again. He was standing there, facing the river with his arms outstretched, and he was almost in shock. He seemed to appear to me at that time that something was wrong with him. So, I was trying to make my way toward him, I was crawling. I couldn't get my legs to work, but before I got to him, my strength came back to my legs, I was getting up on my feet, and I heard this sound, like the sound I heard before, the zipping sound. I glanced around, and I saw the blue flashing lights. The craft was just gone, almost instantly. I made it to Calvin, I shook him and was calling to him, and it took me several minutes to get to him, so I could even talk to him with any sense. He was going in shock. These things that came out of the craft were about 5 feet 4 inches tall, and they didn't have a neck. Their head seemed to come directly to their shoulders. They had something that resembled a nose on a face. About where the ears would be, something that was similar to the nose, only a little lower, it seemed to come out almost to a point. Under the nose there was something like a slit for a mouth, and it was very wrinkled. It seemed, or it appeared to me to be something like elephant skin.
I don't know if it was a metal or what it was, but it seemed to be very wrinkled with the wrinkles going horizontal. In the area where the eyes should have been it was so wrinkled that I'm not even sure there was eyes. I cannot recall if there were any eyes or not and Calvin says he can't. But, anyway after I got Calvin to where I could talk to him, we didn't know what to do and we were almost scared to death.
We first decided we wouldn't tell anyone but the more we talked about it the more we realized that we had to talk to somebody, the military authorities, if nobody else. So we called Keesler Air Force Base which is only about 30 blocks south of here, and I talked to someone who told me that the Air Force didn't handle those things anymore, and that we would have to go through our sheriff's department. Well, then we hesitated again, because, when you go to people, with something like this, it is just not supposed to happen, and you'll probably be laughed at and ridiculed. We talked it over again and decided we would call the sheriff's department and Sheriff Fred Diamond told us to come on over and we'd talk about it. So, we stayed there for several hours talking with him and him questioning us, and the sheriff promised me that there wasn't going to be any news media or anything about it, and that he would get it to the proper authorities if he could find out who the proper authorities were, and have it investigated. So we went home that morning. It was morning because they had kept us there quite late with the assurance that there was not going to be any publicity at all. Well, we went on to work that morning, and by 7 or 8 o'clock there were telephones ringing all over the shipyard. I called Fred Diamond and he said that he doesn't know how the story leaked out of the sheriff's department, but by that time the whole world knew about it.
You said something like an eye ran up and down your body. Do you think it was examining you?
Yes, it had to be some type of examination. It had to be, it appears to me to be, and after talking with a bunch of scientists I'm convinced that it was something, that it was some sort of examination.
Did you communicate with these creatures, these things?
No, they didn't try to communicate with me. The only sound that they made, and I'm not sure if it even came from them, but there was some sort of mumbling sound, a low mumbling sound from one of them.
In 1975 we have the North Hudson Park UFO sightings in New Jersey. This sighting is considered to be a close encounter of the second and third kind, and is the case that introduced Bud Hopkins to UFO research, a key figure in future alien abduction research. Researcher Jerome Clark cites the incident as one of the best documented, since the story was corroborated by numerous independent witnesses. And in 1975 we have the Travis Walton incident in Arizona. This is the incident where logger Travis Walton reported being abducted by aliens for 5 days. Walton's 6 workmates claimed to have witnessed the UFO at the start of his abduction. Walton described the event and its aftermath in The Walton Experience, which was dramatized in the film Fire in the Sky.
The Today Show reports. Travis Walton and a crew of 6 others were returning home, after working in the White Mountains of Arizona. What happened on the way home has become one of the best documented cases of alien abduction, and a mystery that has remained unsolved to this day. On film they can be evil, friendly, or ready for a fight. In the 90s movie Fire in the Sky, aliens abduct a logger from Snowflake, Arizona, while the other crew members look on, but this is no fictional close encounter for Travis Walton. The movie is based on of his personal story.
What's it like for you to come back to these woods, right off the road where the incident happened?
Well, it seems like just yesterday. In a way, a lot of those memories are just so burned into my mind.
So, tell me what happened that night.
We worked till almost dark, and we loaded up our equipment and headed out of there. There's 7 of us in the truck and we're driving along, and we hadn't gone very far, and we saw this glow coming from the trees, and we saw this object hovering there, and it was unmistakable.
Illustrations based on Travis's description show the object that made the crew stop in their tracks. Travis was the only one to get out of the truck for a closer look.
As soon as I straightened up, bam. I just felt this shock. It's kind of like an electric shock actually, but I just blacked out.
The 6 other crew members witnessed the abduction. John Gullett was one of them.
Be back out here again like this. I'm actually kind of scared now.
And you said you saw Travis lifted?
When I turned my head, he was crouched down like this, and when I looked back he was, kind of like this, all spread out.
Fearing for their own lives, the men fled. They returned to the site later that evening, finding no sign of Travis. A massive search and investigation followed.
When he didn't show up after the first 2 or 3 days, we scheduled polygraph examinations for the other individuals who were in the work crew, and they all passed.
So, while all of this is going on, what was happening to you? Where were you? What was going on? What are your memories of how you spent those 5 days?
My first memory after blacking out was of regaining consciousness very slowly. The instant that I saw these creatures and realized where I was, I just completely went crazy with fear. They had these huge eyes that just seemed to look right into me in this really unbearable way.
How did you know it was real and not a dream?
You know how they say pinch yourself? Well, I was feeling a lot more pain than that, so, yeah, it was very real.
5 days later, Travis returned.
And then you woke up where?
I woke up, I was lying face down, outdoors. I could recognize this piece of highway as being outside of Heber. You know, I ran down in here, and it took all the strength I had left to get to these phone booths.
Travis's incredible explanation gained media attention far from the small town of Snowflake, but not everyone believed his story. Travis's incredible explanation gained media attention far from the small town of Snowflake, but not everyone believed his story. Joe Biza, local historian.
They were treated very badly. A lot of people made fun of Travis and the whole crew.
Does it bother you that some people don't believe you?
It used to bother me a lot more. Any more? You know, I think the record speaks for itself.
Has this single event that happened when you were 22 defined your life?
Yeah, it defined my life for me, regrettably. If I had to do it over again, I'd never get out of the truck.
Next, we have the 1976 Allagash abductions in Maine. Here, four campers claim to have been abducted by alien life forms in the Allagash wilderness.
History Channel reports. In the summer of 1976, art students Charlie Fotz, Chuck Rack, and twins Jack and Jim Weiner traveled north from Boston into the wilderness of Maine. For nearly a week, the trip was everything they hoped it would be, a carefree escape from city life. On the fifth day, they camped near Smith Pond, an isolated, stump-filled swamp.
It was the perfect spot for night fishing. It was also the place where their lives would change forever.
Jack Weiner, there was no moon that night, it was real dark, and we didn't want to get lost, so what we did was make a big fire, so we could see it and know which way to go to get back to camp later. Chuck Rack, and it was quite large, but we cleared around the fire so there was no problem. Its flames were leaping a good 3 or 4 feet up into the air. With their makeshift lighthouse aglow, the four men left their campsite behind. They paddled several hundred yards out into the pond, heading toward a night of fishing they would never forget and one they would later illustrate in their artwork. Chuck Rack, I remember paddling leisurely, the twins were in the middle and Charlie was in the front. I remember they were having a conversation and I was focusing on the night, the lake and the water, and I began to feel observed. Jack Weiner, and then suddenly Chuck Rack, who was at the back of the canoe, said, "Holy mackerel, what the heck is that?"
And I turned around and looked, and there was this huge white light that was coming out of the trees. It seemed like it was rising out of the trees.
At first, we thought, well, it's gotta be an airplane or something, right? So, we watched it for a few seconds and we realized that it wasn't an airplane because it wasn't making any sound at all. Chuck Rack, it was strange, very strange. It was a bright, luminous yellow light and changing from that color in a very fluid liquid kind of a way, and we were very, very fascinated. That I was in a state of extreme euphoria. I remember just feeling, wow, this is fantastic. Charlie Fultz, it was just alive, and when it was nearest us about 100 yards away, it paused, and when it paused I said to the fellas, I said, I'm going to shine the flashlight and see what it does. Jim Weiner, the instant he flashed his flashlight this thing sends down this beam of light down to us.
We are in a 16-foot Grumman canoe which in the pitch black of night lit up like a Roman candle. We must have looked like this object, just waiting to be approached on this lake.
Chuck Rack, all I can tell you is what was going through my mind. It's just exhilarating expectation, just this is fantastic, this is something we can communicate with.
It's attempting to communicate with us. Jim Weiner, I was completely shocked. I was especially shocked that it reacted as quickly as it did. Which told us there was some sort of intelligence about it, and as soon as this light came out this thing started moving.
Jack Weiner, and so, we thought, well, this is real, this is really happening, this is not a figment of our imagination. I mean, we've got to deal with this situation, now, because within a few seconds this thing is going to be right on us. Charlie Fultz, I wasn't even interested in this thing anymore, other than I didn't want to be as close to it as I was. I remember paddling as fast as I could and Jack saying, it's getting closer.
It's getting closer. And then it was gone. The next thing they remember, they were back on shore. Dot.
Chuck Rack, and I thought, well, that's it, we've lost our chance. We let it slip through our fingers, and I observed it leaving and just gradually faded out. Exhausted, the four men stumbled back to their campsite.
There they found the remains of their makeshift lighthouse. The fire that they had built to last for hours, the fire that was now just a pile of charred embers. At the time, no one gave it much thought. Though later it would play a large role in their sighting.
That night, nothing more was discussed, not the fire, nor the unknown object that had chased them only moments before.
Sleep was the only thing on their minds. For years, the friends rarely talked about that strange night. Then in 1978, memories of the sighting began to resurface. Jim Weiner had developed temporal epilepsy after a car accident and suffered periodic seizures. These fits were often triggered by sleep deprivation, and by 1980 Jim was definitely not sleeping well.
Vivid nightmares had become a perpetual torment.
Jim Weiner, "All I remember is seeing vague figures isomorphic in shape, but it did not seem human to me.
They were around me and they were either doing things with my genitals, prodding me with some types of instruments. There was an extreme feeling of malevolence.
I mean, I was absolutely, always felt terrified in this situation." For a time, Jim kept his nightmares secret, then he confided it in his brother.
Jack Weiner's reaction was totally unexpected.
Jack Weiner, "So, he starts telling me, this, my nightmare on the phone, and I go, holy mackerel. I've been having the same nightmares, what is going on here?" There was no apparent explanation, but Jim was getting worse, his doctors growing more concerned. Repeatedly they asked Jim what was wrong. That's when he finally revealed the nightmares.
A physiatrist working on the case said it sounded like an abduction experience.
The doctor suggested that Jim speak with Ray Fowler, a UFO researcher.
Jim repeated his story. Fowler took it seriously.
Later the other three also underwent hypnosis. Finally, 4 years after the incident, the details of that terrifying August night would emerge. Charlie Foltz, "I remember suddenly being enveloped in this tube of light, and I remember looking up and thinking, what the heck is that up there? Like, you know what's up there?
And that took a few seconds and I looked back again and Chuck Rack's gone."
Jack Weiner, "The last thing I remember is having both hands on the side of the canoe looking out to the water to see if Chuck was in the water, and then not seeing him and thinking what happened to Chuck. And then looking up, and the next thing I remembered was this intense feeling of, almost like I was, coming apart or something. That's the only way I can describe it, and the next thing I remembered I was being on my back in this hazy environment, which is just like this nightmare that I had been having."
All four friends seem to recall a similar traumatic experience.
Charlie Foltz, "I'm lying on my back and I'm disoriented, I'm not sure where I am, and as I'm forcing and struggling to get up, a face appears and looks straight down at me." Jack Weiner, "They reminded me of insects. I remember thinking, my God, these things look like bugs.
They had these large eyes almost like ants have. They could have been goggles for all I know, but they had some sort of clothing on, like spandex.
I became focused on this thing's hands and realizing that it was not a hand like ours at all. This one had me by the wrist and he was holding my arm up, and I realized that he had something else in his hand, but I didn't like the looks of it, and I remember thinking, oh boy, here we go, this is it, I have 5 seconds to live, they're going to cut me open, they're going to dissect me.
Whatever, I just want to get out of here. Get me out of here."
It would take hours under hypnosis before the four men fully detailed the alien examinations.
Later, they recalled the peculiar events that brought them back down to Earth.
Jim Weiner, "They moved us again into this other space, this room, then this area in front of me started changing somehow, some type of machine or something. It was very strange, and the last thing I remember thinking was, here we go.
I don't know what's gonna happen next, but something is happening."
Chuck Rack, "Under regressive hypnosis I remember aliens trying to put me in the canoe. There's one of them standing in the canoe over me trying to adjust my position in the back of the canoe, and another one was waist deep in the water right next to me. And then, they tried to position Jim Weiner in front of me, but he's heavier and they were having a hard time with him, and then the other two were beamed right on land, and then Jim got out to join them. As their recollections took shape, the four men learned why their roaring campfire had seemed to burn out so quickly. To those who investigate abduction cases, it's known as missing time. Perhaps as much as 3 hours have passed during the abduction from the time the men first saw the UFO till the time they found themselves standing on the beach."
Meanwhile, their fire had burned down to embers.
Hypnosis had restored their recollections of the missing time with unsparing intensity, but now there was no hiding from the memories, no hiding from the trauma of what had apparently happened at Smith Pond.